The views expressed on this show are not necessarily those of Harris Stowe State University or Black Radio Hall of Fame.
Africans at home and throughout the diaspora, unity is strength. We've got the power.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now the time to do the right thing.
We need more unity.
Come.
Stop the fussing and the fighting.
Yeah.
Now's the time to do the right thing.
In the spirit of umoja, embrace with love.
Let's do it right now. We've got to do it right. Stop the fussing and the
right
fighting.
Right now, right now.
Now's the time to do the right thing.
Yes, we are going to jump right into the show because we've lost about 10 good minutes, 10 valuable minutes. And y'all know we can always get more money, but we can't get more time. So, again, my heart goes out to all of the folks who were victimized by the disaster. And I would have to say all of us have been victimized because everybody knows somebody who has lost power, lost a loved one, lost home, lost memories. And so I think we just need to continue stepping up for each other during this time of disaster. And I also want to say, because sometimes people are so buried into the moment that they don't forget that we have paid through taxes to have some relief come to us. Those are in the form of FEMA and other resources that come when you have been designated as a natural disaster area. And I know as early as Saturday morning, the Organization for Black Struggle put out a press release to say, hey, we've seen this scenario before. We know that there is a race and class lens to the way resources are distributed during natural disasters, and we are going to be vigilant about that. And it took a couple of days for FEMA to come because most people don't understand it is the governor that has to request it of the president. So you got two people that really don't give a hoot about Black St. Louis that we got to demand what we got coming. And so and even when I was out over the weekend, people were saying we need the National Guard here to help pick up some of this stuff because there's only so much cleanup people can do with your rake and your broom. There's massive debris that has to be relocated. The average citizen, I don't care what kind of pickup truck you got, cannot do that. We need some help, y'all, and we have to demand that even in the midst of our own suffering and pain. So this person, this serial liar and 34-time convicted felon, is still wreaking havoc. They are decimating FEMA, and they're decimating Health and Human Services at a time when we need them the most. So let's continue to, again, help neighbors with neighbors, but also demand what's rightfully ours. So today's guest, I'm gonna see how fast we can talk to get through all that we were going to get through. But we have guests here from the Office of Civilian Oversight, and those are that's the office that houses the Civilian Oversight Board and the Detention Facility Oversight Board. And so there's been a lot happen with that, you all, as you know. And on top of that, we got a significant blow for the state legislature that has definitely taken civilian local control from its citizens. And so that's still an ongoing fight. We haven't given up on that. But we have in the studio today Dr. Barbara Milan, who is the commissioner of the office. We have Reddick Hudson and Louisa Laus, who are investigators, I would say competent investigators in that office. And we have Ruby Bonner. And Ruby, you have had several titles over there. So what's the current title?
The current title, and always has been, first of all, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
And thank you for having us. It's a real honor. My official title is Executive Assistant.
Executive Assistant. Okay. Yes. I thought at one point you were Interim Commissioner.
Well, I did serve in that capacity for about a year after the former Commissioner resigned unexpectedly.
Okay, so that's what I'm saying. I remember different titles.
I was told, don't use interim. So I have a designation as deputy commissioner from the director of public safety.
So those were all the things rolling around in my head, and I knew there was.
Sure.
Yeah, but I know there's been some reorganization, and so what it looks like now is you always have to be up to date. So Dr. Milan and Reddick and Louisa, who I know all very well, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Yeah. So let's get started. We're going to start with the civilian oversight first. And that's one that's, you know, dear to my heart because I've been on that case for over 20 years. And so we've seen a rocky road for civilian oversight, but I think it was even rockier for the Detention Facility Oversight Board. But what we have now and why we are here today is that there are two reports that have been put out. And if you're close to a computer, you can join us and walk through it with us because it's on the website of the Office of Oversight. And so just, you know, Google City of St. Louis and go to Office of Civilian Oversight and to the report. And so I'm going to start not so much with the report, but I'm going to ask Louisa and Dr. Milan to talk about the history of the office, how it came about, and then we'll jump into the report.
Well, the civilian, first of all, thank you so much, Jamala, for inviting us to participate in today. We really do appreciate this opportunity and all the good work that you are providing in communications and supporting awareness in the community about different issues. And we share, as you have expressed, the sentiment for all of our neighbors who have been impacted by the devastation of the tornado. And we share with you and giving voice that we do need to have assistance federally for the residents and the families who have been impacted by the tornado. But the Civilian Oversight Board was established in 2015 following Black Lives Matter protest in Ferguson. The Civilian Oversight Board is one of two boards that we have responsibility for. It's a very unique situation for any entity to have two boards in which they report to. The mission of the Division of Civilian Oversight is to prioritize the safety of both the public and city employees, strengthen the reliability of criminal justice agencies, and to promote transparency, fairness, and accountability to the highest professional standards by both the St. Louis Metropolitan Police Department as well as the City Justice Center. I do want to say that we have been fortunate in our relationship with the St. Louis Metropolitan Police Department as well as the City Justice Center. We are meeting with both the police department and the City Justice Center on a regular scheduled basis monthly. And I have great confidence in the fact that we have been able to have this opportunity because we know by being able to communicate and to discuss issues, we may have 90 things that we disagree on, but if we can find one thing that we can agree on, then we want to galvanize our energies, our resources to support that one area. So our office is responsible for investigations of misconduct that have occurred with the police department and or the City Justice Center.
Okay, and I would just clarify by saying, yes, the civilian oversight was established in 2015, but that was prior to a 20-year struggle. And shortly before then, Mayor Slay had actually vetoed that. And so I can only say that the Ferguson uprising made him change his mind. What can I say? Okay, so I'm going to go to Louisa to talk about what your role has been, because you actually have been a mainstay for the full time
of the office. And it, at one point, I think you might have been the only staffer in the office. And so,
yes, I was the only staffer in the office for about 7 months. That was from in 2022, from January to basically July of that year. One of the things that, when you said I was been there for, since day one, when we originally started, we were doing this oversight of the police department. Although the original ordinance called for us to be able to do complete investigations, we never got an opportunity to do that for several reasons. One of the things that occurred when the ordinance was written, and it's a very well-written ordinance, I will say that, because I can tell, having been, I'm also a part of the National Association of Civilian Oversight of Law Enforcement, and therefore I can tell that that ordinance was written based on New York, Chicago, Denver, and Los Angeles. So they're very well-written ordinance. However, one of the things that occurred immediately was pushback. Mm-hmm. The ordinance was written, and in the ordinance, you'll see that we, the police department and the civilian oversight board joined together to develop a joint civilian oversight form.
Mm-hmm. Complaint form.
Complaint form. But what they did not say was that the police department had to discontinue the uses of their internal affairs form for their complaints. And so what occurred from 2016 to really April, August, of 2021, if someone came to the civilian oversight office located 1520 Market in room 4029 and they filed a complaint, then our office would handle that complaint. And the process would be in which we would receive the complaint, it would go to the Internal Affairs Department, and they would do the investigation. Once they completed their investigation, they would then return the complaint form and all their documentation for their investigation for the civilian oversight staff to review. Now, I will have to say that at that time, we only had two investigators, right, myself and one other person. I'll also say, because the ordinance did not say they had to discontinue using theirs, most people didn't know we existed.
Right.
And so they were still going to 1915 Olive, filling out a complaint form with Internal Affairs, which meant that we were getting roughly 20 to 25 complaints for the year. When in 2021, when former Mayor Jones was elected, she was made aware by our office that we were not getting all the complaints. Because people would call off and say, hey, look, I filed a complaint. What's the status? And we go, we don't even know what you're talking about. Right. So I will say this, that when we did contact the Internal Affairs Department, said we received a call from this individual, they would then forward over their complaint form. That would have made us aware that they were still using theirs. We found out that we weren't getting everything. So former Mayor Jones, what she did was she filled us Executive Order Number 1. Mm-hmm. Executive Order Number 1 said, hey, look, Internal Affairs, you will give Civilian Oversight Board all your complaints. Now, that's when things get really interesting, because she did that on April the 21st of 2021. And at that time, our office only had 9 complaints. By December of 2021, we had 155 complaints. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that always comes out of people talk about, why do we have a backlog? Because everybody, if you look at our reports on our website, you'll see we have a backlog. Well, when she signed that in April 2021, except we only had 4 people in office. We had the executive assistant, which functions as a commissioner, 2 investigators, myself, 1 other investigator, and the secretary. That's all we had. So when she signed that, and September the secretary resigned and got another position. Then the 1 other investigator, he resigned and got another position. And by December, the commissioner resigned and she got another position. So, Ms. Rogers, when you talk about how at one point in time I was the only person, that meant when January 2022 came, up until basically July, I was the only person in office. But the complaints were still coming in.
Right, right.
You know, and they were coming in at a fast force. As a matter of fact, in 2022, we have on our website, we have our updated complaint form going from 2000 20 up until 2023. And in 2022, we received 126 complaints. In 2023, we received 194. And 2024, we received 197. And so in 2025, to date, we've received 196. We never had a full complement of staff. When then the director of public safety, Dr. Dan Isom, had said to me, he said, you know, when this ordinance was written for you all to get everything, it was meant for you all to have a staff of 35. Well, I think we have a staff of about 10 people to
date. Right.
So we're still getting the complaints in. We're still doing everything that needs to be done. And like Dr. Milan had said earlier, we are meeting with the police department trying to establish some type of rapport that we can move forward, because they do not know how this state taker is going to take affect us either as well.
So I just want to let the listeners know a little bit of background to what Luis is saying. The Organization for Black Struggles started in 1980. Even before then, some of us were involved with police accountability. And so for us, it's been a long, treacherous history of trying to relate to the police department and get justice for victims of police brutality and police murders. So we would always encourage people to file complaints, because when they did their annual reports, they would say, we're doing fine, no complaints, you know, we do. And it's because people did not want to go to the police station, which at that time was 12th and Clark, to file, because they made it so difficult. It was so intimidating. First of all, you had to sign in when you come in. Then you had to go to the fifth or sixth floor. And people were like, I'm scared. And so the OBS would send somebody with them who knew the process. But before then, literally, the internal affairs would throw complaints in the trash, saying this is not valid. I'm tell you right now, and throw it in the trash. So it was just a disappointing, disheartening kind of process. So with all of that in mind, and also because St. Louis was almost the last urban area to get civilian oversight boards, we had the benefit of going to all of those other cities and extracting from them what had worked and what didn't. And so we said, we got to make sure ours is working, and there's no reason for us not to put this in there. And so I think, to his credit, Terry Kennedy really helped shepherd the bill through us, and it went through several reiterations, because sometimes it was just not ready for a vote. But when it did happen, and I just want to reiterate that there had been resistance from day one from the police department. So, so I think the fact that now it's local control has been, you know, seized by the state is a welcome sign for them, because they were having a hard time being accountable to the cities, the citizens that they served. And they didn't like that, because they've been able to have a certain amount of autonomy over processes, procedures, protocols, and budget. That's the big thing, and budget, where they did not have to respond to anybody, including sometimes the older people. So this was a monumental victory for us to have that. And even though people didn't know it existed for a while, they do now. And so we got to make sure that it's still a smooth process. I do want to hear from Reddick Hudson and Ruby, because they bring some unique skills with them. Reddick, and probably some people know this, but very few, because he doesn't act like one. Reddick used to be a member of the St. Louis Police Department, and since his departure from there, has been a significant national voice for reform and for transformation of that department. So, Reddick, what have you seen in the last 20 years that would give you hope that this is going to be a department that is going to be open to change?
20 years is a long time, and I've seen a lot in those 20 years. I want to commend you personally for, you know, the fact that we're sitting here in this civilian oversight board and the investigators who were on it. Myself, Louisa Lyles, Answer May, Marco Lester, Cora Baker, your work. You, John Chasnoff, the Organization for Black Struggle, CAPCOR, Coalition Against Police Crimes and Repression, the community's work and pressure over decades, culminating with the death of Michael Brown and the genesis for action that created, is why we sit here right now. I think I'm hopeful in the context of external factors, right? The public has become increasingly aware. I mean, the black community was always aware. Marginalized communities have always been aware of the issues that exist when they come in contact with police. But I think the advent of cell phones, cameras, and videos have made those issues very real for a broader slice of public in America, and given some momentum to the idea that, okay, there is a need for some independent arbiter to investigate situations like this and weigh in terms of who's going to be held accountable. Historically, as you pointed out, I mean, candidly, anytime historically people have called for real accountability for police officers, a lot of times that gets characterized as being anti-police. No matter what. If I simply call for you to be accountable in executing your responsibility as a law enforcement officer, it's easy for you to then characterize me as attacking law enforcement, which is not true. So I'm hopeful that the momentum that's been created by the work of people like yourself and others, and a whole new wave of young leaders who also have done hard work to create a space for civilian oversight to exist, continues going forward.
So I think it is, because I can hear Reddick, so at least through my phone, but you're not hearing him. Okay, well, you just missed some more of his wisdom. Yeah, we do, for whatever reason, we just seem to be plagued with problems. But this I think coming, and I always would tell Reddick that his voice is an authentic one when it comes to transformation of the police department, because he was in the inside. He saw what was going on. He felt what was going on. He heard what was going on. And who better to lead the charge of transformation than a former member of the St. Louis Police Department? Because I think you would have to agree that you went in thinking you were going to be serving your community.
Sure. Charles Alford, if you remember him.
Oh, yeah.
One of the first black commanders on the St. Louis Police Department back in the 70s was one of the coaches of our baseball team. My dad was a coach. They were friends. And he was the first example I saw of somebody from our community in law enforcement who was there for all the right reasons, right, to help the community from an empowered position. But certainly it was inescapable to me. I didn't come into the department unaware of the history between police officers and police departments in the black community generally. And when I got there, you know, some of my experiences confirmed some of the worst aspects of it. Even though there were still officers there who were trying to do things the right way, I'll summarize that this way. Sergeant Keith Williams, who wrote use of force policy for the St. Louis Police Department in the 90s, said this, and I tend to agree with him. He said, on any given day in any major city, 15% of your police department is going to do the right thing all the time, no matter what, whether anybody's looking or not. You got 15% that may go the wrong way, no matter what, abuse that authority. That leaves 70% of your department that could go either way, depending on
leadership
and who wields the most influence inside of that space. So, you know, you need an entity like ours who is independent of and dispassionate about our assessment of your action. We just look at facts and evidence, and we land where those things put us.
Yeah. The thing about Captain Alpin was that he promoted a nonviolent philosophy because he was associated with the King Center, and I thought that was quite an oxymoron that you police advocate nonviolence, but you know, I love him.
He got there after he left. he left the police department to go to work for the King Center in Atlanta.
Yeah, but he had started his nonviolent thing before then, yeah. Just trying to do that. Because I remember at one point he told me, Jamala, I have never fired my gun in his 20-something years. Right. And so that struck me as saying, so if you have that philosophy in your head, that's going to be the way your first response is, as opposed to pull out my weapon and start shooting. Right. So he was already implementing in his own way a nonviolent approach to policing before he left. But he was a character. I really respected him. For you, Ruby, your background is in law. And so you have some idea of what it means for people to be on either side. Either they are filing complaints or lawsuits or whatever, and just being in the community hearing about police abuses, what do you think you bring to the office?
Well, I'll tell you, Jamala, I actually had my first job out of high school with the police department. I went to work there as a teleprocessing clerk. So I had that experience, and at one time, because, and I'm really dating myself, there were only three women on the police department when I went to work there. And there was one who was an African-American female. People during my years will definitely remember her, Eleanor Hall. She was the first. And, you know, there weren't a whole lot of role models for me back then, and I just loved watching her in that uniform. And so I decided maybe I should become a police person. And then by the time I got old enough, they had put a freeze on hiring women. And by that time,
as if they had so many.
Right, they had a freeze on it for some reason. So then I left the police department, got married, and did that whole thing. Came back to St. Louis some years later, but I had experienced some amount of community protesting, again dating myself around the Vietnam War. I remember being captured by Associated Press on the steps of the state office building. So all of this activity, my decision to go to law school after coming back to St. Louis, hearing about the work of Percy Green and being informed by that, and prior to that, Dr. King and his death. I was in Madison, Wisconsin at the time that he died, and was taking in all of the reactions. So when I got to St. Louis, even after electing a first African-American congressman, I was expecting things to have changed in St. Louis. I was expecting that things would be far more progressive than what I found in the city that had given me so much personally. And so I've always looked for ways, no matter where I worked, and I worked at many different places. I'm a former prosecutor. Worked at very many places in law-related areas. But regardless of where I've gone, I've always tried to make a difference in terms of uplifting my community in whatever way that I could. And so I happened to be reading an article about civilian oversight, and I'd known about it because I sat in on some of those hearings, Jamala, mm-hmm. where you were when former Alderman Kennedy was shepherding through the legislation through the Public Safety Committee. So I've always had an interest, but I read in depth what had been going on when the commissioner before Matthew Brahman mm-hmm. left, and there was a lot of talk about what had been happening, what had not been happening, that sort exactly. of thing. And I did decide, since I had just retired from my second job, I decided, well, you know, I think I can help. I think I bring the kind of uniqueness there, having worked on both sides of the equation. I have family, friends that are police officers. I believe I can bring neutrality and objectivity from both sides. And that really was one of the reasons why I decided to apply. Okay. And initially applied for the commissioner spot. Did not get it, and once I got there, I was so fortunate. I felt so fortunate because I had no idea, and I don't believe the community does either, of the amount of pushback.
Yeah.
I could not believe. I just couldn't believe.
Your hands keep
But I think all folks who have had any amount of interaction with the police department and know how long they've been able to, like I said, operate autonomously, that they would be that kind of pushback. I know we don't have the same amount of time that we did starting out, so we're going to not do the detention facility oversight report. We're going to start with the COB. And I hope what you hear us discussing will make you want to go to the website to check out not just the report on the civilian oversight, but also the detention facility board. But here's the thing that I think we would help our listeners understand. With the report, and we know this is mainly 23-22, what were some of the highlights? What were some of the trends you saw? And I'm going to direct this to you, Dr. Milan. What did you see, and what did you all, with all the data that was collected, what were some of the trends? And if, you know, other folks can help you too. Y'all know y'all read this report backwards and forward.
Ms. Rogers, now what you were showing previously was some data that spoke to our efforts to address some of the older cases. That was showing data just for letters that were sent.
Okay, so my question now for you all is, what were the trends over those 2 years that you collected the data from? Where were the complaints coming from? What was the people mostly complaining about?
Yes, you're absolutely correct. The data speaks to a consistent identification of misconduct. Over the years in which Louisa identified from 2020 up until 2023. And I don't have the information in front of me, but we know that there was misconduct and that is persistent through all of those years. We are now in the process of doing the analysis for 2024. Once that analysis is completed, we will be presenting information to the board for their deliberation, and Louisa can speak to that, but I believe the approach will have to involve our review of the policies. What is in place and what is happening? And are we seeing the same individuals or situations occurring? And we are seeing the same situations occur from year after year. And so we will need to determine what is being done and if there is going to be a proactive approach to address this. I think the data will also be able to specify, at least we want to look at, are they the same individuals that are involved from 1 year to the next year? And if that is established, then we do have a serious problem.
So one of the things when I was reading the report, it kept referring to a high percentage of the folks were saying, and this is a term that I think probably needs some explanation, it was failure to conduct a proper investigation. So what exactly does that mean? Does it mean that it wasn't even explored, or what does that mean?
It could mean exactly that, as well as the fact that when they did get the information, they did kind of dismiss it. You know, what we found was that on too many occasions, a lot of times, let's be honest, our complainants, sometimes when they write their alleged misconduct, they're going from emotional. So they'll write a whole 2-3 pages of emotions, and you get maybe 2-3 words that really you can hang your head on. That's why it's so important. I also want to mention the fact in ways they can file their reports, complaints, because that's very important. They can go to our website, Civilian Oversight website, online, and when they do go online, they can actually now fill out the complaint forms online. They can come to our office at 1520 Market, room 4029. They can call our office, area code 314-657-1600, and they can request that we mail them a complaint form. And one of the things we do, we our investigative staff, we have four very good investigators, five really in all actuality. Reddick Hudson mentioned their names, and I like to commend them. When people come in, we help them put in writing what their complaint is really all about. Because the better written the complaint is, the more the police department going to pay attention to it. We also, because Reddick Hudson is not the only investigator in office who has police background. Marco Lester also comes from the police department. Answer May, he comes from the probation and parole. I was with the circuit attorney's office and the Department of Corrections. I've been dealing with police for quite a while. Cora Baker comes from corrections. And anybody who ever worked in corrections, you know we have contact with the police department. And so we work very closely with the individuals to make sure their complaint is complete, saying what he wants to say. We also have an opportunity when the police department interviews the complainants, we actually go in and sit in on that interview. So we try to encourage them to come to our office for the interview, but like you mentioned earlier, people did not file complaints because they were intimidated by going to the police headquarters. So I want to let them know that we will be there with them if they should go there. But because the complaints are being more, we're sitting down with the complainants, asking them do they have video footage, the witness information, any other documentation. Also, our investigators go out and they look at federal law, state law, local law. When we're doing more in-depth, preliminary investigations as well. So what we're finding is that at one time the police department was not doing a proper investigation, but we find that the more proactive we are, because we are the liaison between the community and the police department as well as corrections, the more proactive we are, and we are the voice for those who are voiceless.
Jamala, you talked about the state preemption. The Board of Aldermen passed a very, very good ordinance that gave us independent investigation. And that was preempted by litigation last year,
right,
by the state. So it takes us back to reviewing, simply reviewing investigations that are completed by IAD. So I'm agreeing with Louisa. We are still saying if we're only going to review, we're going to review very thoroughly. If we find that we've not gotten a particular witness's statement, we're going to pursue that witness for a statement. We're going to look at what policies and authorities, as Commissioner Mylan has indicated, because I believe even under this more restricted legislation that was passed before the state takeover, a lot of the authority and power that was given to civilian oversight by the Board of Aldermen has been preempted.
Yeah. And I'm glad you mentioned that, because again, this is when I'm talking about a rocky road, because we started off with pretty high hopes because of the nature of the legislature that, you know, gave the COB subpoena power. It gave them, yes, all the things that we had looked at across the country that folks didn't have, and therefore their efforts were pretty toothless. The other thing that came across was funding of the office, and we like, okay, no, they got to have funding. So that's where that 35 member office came from, where we said we're going to make sure there's money for that. Of course, that has not happened. So I don't know how familiar you are, Reddick, with the report, but I, you know, one of the things I noted was who was filing the complaints, and so the age of those folks filing the complaints, and I think younger people, most folks would think, are the recipients of bad behavior from the police department, just based on the fact that folks are young people are
more likely to come in contact.
But also more responsive to the police in ways that probably, you know, of somebody. But I didn't see that in the age group. I saw like from 30 to 50 something who were filing the complaints. Do you have any insight about that particular finding?
I don't have a particular insight about it, other than young people may have at some point just decided that whatever is part of the system, any part of the system, is not going to be as effective as they would want it to be, and they find other ways to voice their complaint. Sometimes they even take it to the street, as you know.
Yes.
I don't have any, any solid sense of why those numbers look like
that. Yeah, that was interesting to me. And I felt like maybe some of the older folks were saying, you know, there is a process. I'm going to use that process. And young folks, like you said, the hell with that. Right. Whole damn system is corrupt.
Have given up on process.
Yeah, but that was interesting. Anything else that surprised you all about what was coming out of the data and what people were saying about their interactions with the police department?
I would like to say this. At one time, I think it was in 2018, there was an article put out that the civilian oversight was primarily agreeing with the police department. That did change. That's why come that aggressiveness on the part of the investigators and interaction with the complainants more opened the door for that did start turning around. We also noticed something else. As we started pulling the cover off of the misconduct of the police department, they went from excessive use of force and start saying uncivil treatment.
Yeah, I checked out that new term.
They changed the terminology that they were using, uncivil treatment. So that softened the blow on their end. It made it look like we're not really that bad. And I'm not going to say they are, because I'm just like Ms. Bonner. I have family members who are police officers as well. But bad behavior is bad behavior. I don't care who it is.
Well, I just because Reddick mentioned this about excessive use of force. A year and a half ago, I was part of a task force, was asked to be on that task force to review deadly force of the police department. And we worked on that committee for about a year, myself, another attorney, folks from the police department, and we went through that whole section. And it was quite informative, and I learned a lot. But what we came up with was a pretty damn good policy. Mm-hmm. That policy then was turned over to the new police chief who was just coming on board. And I understand he was told, here's a report, but you do what you think is best. So we don't even know if it was ever read, mm-hmm. ever looked at, ever explored, ever any parts of it implemented. So, you know, I told them that depending on how this thing worked out, that's probably going to be my last time serving on the board, like, because I was already suspicious of where it was going to go just because of the nature of it. But guess what? Other cities have found it so profound, they are using it. Yeah. So we were a model that we ain't even using in our own damn city. Right. What is up with that? So my point is that we know we have a resistant police department. And we had one of their own on that thing that would often tell us, okay, that's probably what you all are trying to do is probably not going to go, but here's what can happen. And so we were looking for alternative language. But one of the things we found, Reddick, is that the big thing for all of the different sections of that policy was that there was never any warning that something was getting ready to happen that was going to be bad or deadly. So you ride up on somebody and you just shoot them. I mean, as opposed to police, you know, and I know people say, like, let's do a warning shot in the air. Well, that's on TV. You don't do that. And then what we also know is they're trained to hit the mass of the body, so they ain't trying to shoot somebody in the leg to stop them, all of that. But you should be given verbal commands, and there's plenty other things that are usable, including, you know, tasers, whatever, talking to somebody, de-escalating that. So what is your thoughts about that?
That's been an area of concern for forever. I mean, that's the primary area of concern when it comes to police accountability and police community interactions. The use of excessive force or deadly force is at the top of the list. I don't know for sure what Chief Tracy has done relative to adopting any new policies. We're probably going to be in the process of finding that out here soon because of some of the cases that are being reviewed right now by investigators at COB. We'll need to know what those policies are, so we'll probably secure those from him at some point. I'm hopeful that they have adopted best practice policies going forward, just given the history of police and community relations in this city, which at one point was per capita the top police department in the country for police-involved shootings. A dubious distinction, I think those numbers have changed recently. I know they've come down, and I'm hopeful that that is the result of not only training, but a different approach from law enforcement who are working in the city of St. Louis. So hopefully going forward, there'll be some clarification around policy. There'll be some improvement with training, and we'll be able to function as effectively as we can, given the constraints that Attorney Ruby Bonner described to you, which are very real. Given the constraints that we exist in, hopefully we can continue to provide objective investigations based on facts and evidence, and provide accountability when necessary, guidance when necessary, and policy recommendations where they're needed.
So, I, you know, in the few minutes that we have left, I really want to zero in on where we go next. We got data. So one of my questions was, as I was going through the report, is, are we overlaying the trends that are coming out of the civilian oversight with the data that we are collecting by the state in terms of vehicular? Because one of the things with the state, that the office, Attorney General's office collects that data on stops, and that came from a racial profiling bill that we fought for in 2000. Every year, the data says there is racial profiling. And the thing that we have put part of the bill was, what that means is police departments can double down, see where those complaints are coming from, and then if it's a district, they can intervene. If it's a particular police officer, they can intervene. None of that has ever happened over the 20-something years that we've been collecting that data. So is that some data that you all can look at to see, for example, Doctor, you talked about, like, if there's a particular officer, then you go, you know, that gives you some more information about intervention. How or should those two data sets be reconciled?
You know, it's a very good point, and I would like to request that the report that you have provided to me, because we need that information. Rest assured, we will be following up. We will stand up for a response for trends, for patterns, for individuals. That is what our responsibility is. As Reddick has mentioned, Louisa has mentioned, Ruby has referred to it as well. We have a charge, and we are going to be reviewing. We will be looking at the policies. We will be asking very serious questions. All of that is to lead to accountability. And may I also mention that soon we will be featuring a dashboard on our website. The purpose of that dashboard is so that members of the community will be able to see for themselves information about allegations, misconduct, and also the status of cases. So we're very close to being able to launch that. And I might also add that that dashboard is based on a model of the Chicago Oversight Board.
So I think there's so much more that we didn't get to, y'all, with this technical difficulty. We need to have you back to talk about the Detention Facility Oversight Board, because they are in great need of members. And so you can go to the website and put your application in for that. But I think we still have to persevere, y'all. We've gotten some obstacles, but that's all there are, obstacles. And the mission and even the whole existence of this office is based on people like you. And so it's in our vested interest to really, you know, still fight the fight for folks. And the people that are in the office right now, I am highly confident in their abilities to carry out. I mean, it's been a while before we got to the right sort of combination of people, but I think we have that now. And so it really is in some ways a shame that we are getting some of the powers and authority stripped. But, you know, we're going to persevere. And so I think, you know, that's where we are right now. So Dr. Barbara Milan, Louisa Lowes, Reddick Hudson, Ruby Bonner, thanks for joining us today, and we're going to have you back as soon as we can. And we will not have the same problem that we've been having. So the music is not coming up, y'all. So this is Jamala Rogers, your host, and I will see you on the battlefield.
Thank you, Jamala.
You're welcome.
You are so